I'd like to call this meeting of House Education to order. It is 8:03 on President's Day, and thanks, everybody, for being able to show up. Present are Representative Keller, Representative Wilson, Representative Gardner, Representative Edmond, Representative Booth, myself, Chair Seaton. And at this time, I'd like to remind everybody about their cell phones. And today, we will hear a presentation from the Department of Education and Early Development on No Child Left Behind. And what we're going to do is get a little more of an overview exactly how it's been structured and working and how it hasn't been working, what things that we've had to try to request as a state for waivers or to work around some of the problems that are unique to our state. And following that discussion, we'll start a discussion on required minimum expenditure for instruction. We talked about that briefly at a previous meeting. And we'll get the administration's take on what modifications they see as beneficial. And then we will begin discussions on HB 94 post-secondary scholarships. Again, I want to remind everybody on these broad issues, this one on scholarships, we're not planning at this point in time to move that bill. There's several bills in the works. There's several discussions on how to best approach that. And we had the presentation by the Taylor Foundation earlier. And so for any listening public, we want to consider all aspects and different approaches to post-secondary scholarships. So with that, I want to recognize Representative Munoz is also with us here today, and at least one member is going to have to leave a little bit early, not for, you know, for other duties.
Lack of interest.
anything else to come before the committee before we start? Mr. Jeans stepped out for a minute, so the department, would you come forward and... Morning.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Les Morse, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Education and Early Development. And I'm going to be speaking on No Child Left Behind, and to give you a sense of what I'll talk about, it'll be, you know, basically what No Child Left Behind is, the requirements of No Child Left Behind, what it funds and what it doesn't fund, and how it is working in Alaska. And I may refer to a couple of documents that I believe you have on hand. One is the budget document that that gives the overview of our budget. And just show you what it looks like so you know which one I'm talking about. And the page, if I do refer to that, that would be helpful for us understanding on the funding issues, would be page 9 that speaks to the Division of Teaching and Learning Support. Also on February 5th, you were provided a document by Cindy Curran that on the final page of that document, there is a pie chart. It looks like this. I may refer to that as well, but it will depend on the questions that you ask. So I just wanted you to have those and know which pages that I would refer to if I do so. First off, what No Child Left Behind is really an amendment to an earlier act that's been on the books since 1965. In 1965, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act was passed by the federal government. That act is specifically targets students who are in schools where those students are low income. There's a threshold of, or a large number of students in schools that are low income. Often we refer to those schools as Title I schools. The act has been amended several times. The first act passed and lasts through 1970, but it's been amended several times. In the early 90s, it was amended, and at that time, we would have heard Improving America Schools Act, and often educators called it IASA. In 2001, a proposal came forward that became a law, and that was No Child Left Behind, NCLB. So NCLB is the amended version of what you'll sometimes hear educators use, ESEA, which is the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. The number one thing to keep in mind about the law is it is about making sure students who are low income have an opportunity to be successful in schools and be evaluated the same way that all other students are evaluated in all other schools. Before NCLB, there was a system of judging schools. There was an AYP that existed. It only applied to Title I schools. And so you probably didn't hear about it as much. What happened when NCLB passed, the law was very clear, and it said the way that you evaluate your Title I schools must be the same way you evaluate all schools in your state. And for some states, it meant they had to build an accountability system for the first time for all of their schools, because previous to that, some states only evaluated their Title I schools. And it also required that the evaluation system be very public. And that's, again, why you will hear more about it today. It affects all schools in terms of their evaluation of those schools. But overall, it's designed to make sure that, again, our low-income students in those Title I schools have the same opportunities and have supports when they're struggling to perform well on academic areas. And specifically, it focuses, for testing purposes, on reading and mathematics. In Alaska, it also requires a science assessment. And in Alaska, we also assess writing, but that's a state choice. It's actually in our state statute, we'll assess writing, and that's why we do writing in addition to that. So overall, that is what No Child Left Behind is. Let me mention one other piece. You hear about highly qualified a great deal. Well, the reason you hear about highly qualified is the law said we need to make sure teachers have content knowledge. When they're going to teach mathematics, they should know mathematics. When they're going to teach reading, they should know reading. And that's really where the highly qualified comes into play. It also said that in the law that if they're going to teach other areas in the non-tested areas, including history, they should know history if you're going to teach history. It does bring a challenge to us in Alaska because we have a large number of schools where there will be three or fewer teachers. Les. And they have to be highly qualified in multiple areas.
Excuse me, Les, just for clarification, is that for elementary and secondary schools, or is it, can you give us any distinction between those two?
Yeah, Chair Seaton, there, the requirement holds through at all of the grade levels, but the requirement in terms of the amount of content knowledge and the requirement at the elementary is different. So an elementary teacher could become highly qualified by passing a generalist type of assessment that makes sure they have an adequate amount of knowledge, less than certainly what a high school history teacher would have to have, but they would know some areas of social studies. So the requirements of what the cut level is or how much you need to know is very different, both at the high school from middle grades, from the elementary grades.
So just for clarification then, are there three different cuts in middle school, or what are those breakdowns, or is it just a single through eighth grade? Or
I believe what we have is a secondary and then elementary, and where it changes typically is that up through sixth grade would be elementary, and then seventh grade up would be the secondary.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, we have another question. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hopefully I'm not jumping ahead of your presentation here, but a quick question. Did Title II, III, and IV then come about in 2001, those funding streams?
Yes. The on that pie chart, and actually if you go to our original budget document, it lays out the budget document would be the best, and if you refer to page 9 of that, you'll see various title programs if you go down the program component side. And then if you look at the second column on the budget sheet where it says federal NCLB, all of those came about as a result of No Child Left Behind. All of those titles fall under No Child Left Behind. And then the funding level is on that budget document. And see, there's other federal funds that come into the department, but this clearly articulates in this budget document which funds are NCLB funds.
Okay, and Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Less of, we know that when No Child Left Behind came into place, that there was funding that came with it. However, it was supplanted by funding that had already been coming to us in other areas. And so which areas got kind of left off in favor of these, and were the schools then, did they have to either continue those other programs, or what kind of explain that to us?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, what happened when NCLB came about, there were programs that were part of the previous authorization called Improving America Schools Act. Those ended, and if programs under that program continued, then that would be the district's choice, but they came, NCLB took over for that law. It was a new authorization of the same law. Most of the requirements were fairly consistent in that change, because the work being done behind NCLB in terms of designing it had been going on for some time. That law, which goes back to 65, is reauthorized about every 5 years. Sometimes it continues forward until the reauthorization language can be built. There was more of a focus on making sure students are prepared for reading and mathematics, and so there were things that were brought into focus in that area. The previous law required standards to be developed by every state in multiple content areas, including social studies, history, geography, various areas of science. This law became very focused on reading and mathematics as a core.
Thank you. Follow up, Representative Wilson.
I guess what I want to follow up then. So what did most of the schools do in this state? Did they just drop the other programs and work on these, or were there, I mean, how did it jive?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, you would have seen things working so that they're more focused. So if we had, one of the things that could be funded in a school would be having instructional support, perhaps teachers, perhaps instructional paraprofessionals, aides in the school that work on supporting students. The shift that would occur is they would have to target their focus on reading and mathematics versus being spread out across all the content areas. So the law created more focus in that sense, is what it did. It really didn't mean you had to completely drop something you previously had. You had to bring focus to it on reading and mathematics. And then there are pieces that come about in terms of a school not meeting adequate yearly progress and a set of consequences they face.
I'm sorry, but I...
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, Mike, I'm going to repeat my question. What did most of the schools in the state of Alaska do, you know, when this came about? Did they keep the other programs plus these programs, or did they drop the other programs? And I know what you're saying is that this narrowed it down instead of trying to be broad and really work on lots of different things for kids. They started just doing reading and math. But so what did we do in this state? Just kind of zeroed over into reading and math?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it really was a refocusing. There, in terms of programs dropped, I wouldn't call any program dropped, because the programs were to provide instructional support. So those programs shifted in terms of them becoming focused. But I don't believe we could say a program would be necessarily dropped, because it may have, the program would have funded an instructional assistant, a person to work there. That person now had to become more focused in what they were doing, what they supported, and very targeted. So they had to assess what are they doing, so that they make sure what they're doing has a success rate, or that they evaluate its success rate.
For clarity on my point, are we talking about, let's say, social studies, and now support has to be focused on reading or math within social studies and how we measure that and measure success. But, I mean, it doesn't mean you eliminate social studies and go to a strictly reading program, but you have to incorporate or have to measure the reading content in social studies. Am I understanding that correctly?
Chair Seaton, that's exactly correct. So if the aide is going in to provide support in social studies, the support they're providing is to help students better be able to read the social studies content. I mean, those are the kinds of focus that it would provide. But it doesn't necessarily mean we're asking schools not to teach social studies. We very much are asking them still to do that. The NCLB component of it is to support reading within that area.
Okay. Representative Wilson and then Representative Keller.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess what I'm getting at is because I've heard schools complain because they have to do both and they were only getting funding for one because it switched from providing the funding for the first one, even though they need to continue it, and the funding was switched to a different area.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there's nothing, the old law went away. It was reauthorized as the NCLB.
I hear what you're saying. So. Thank you.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, just in general, your opinion on Title I money. I mean, is there evidence that it has made a big difference? Been around for how many years? 40, what, some years? And a lot of money been funneled through it, including NCLB, just the big picture from 100,000 feet. Are we seeing huge increases in proficiency of the students?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, we, in the 5 years that we've been testing students, we have seen increases in proficiency. They've been gradual, which that's what you would expect. If they're large jumps, it would make me suspicious. So I think what NCLB did for us is it created a focus. It created attention in a way that because it has, there's very clear guidelines of what the accountability must look like across the country. And as states put the system in place, there was some ability to make sure there was some comparisons across states, as well as it made the information that we tested students on and how we held schools accountable very public in a way that was not previously so. So the gains have been gradual, but the law has had an incredible impact. It doesn't mean that everything is perfect with the law. There are challenges and problems, but it has raised an awareness and a level of attention to all students' achievement in a way that had not previously existed. And again, the law has been in place since 65. I've been in the education business since the mid-80s, and this law brought a lot of attention to the challenges that we have.
And I want to recognize that Representative Guttenberg has been with us for quite a while. Sorry I missed you back there. If you'd like to join us up at the table, we can get a chair up here for you. Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Les.
Let me go on. I mentioned that already that the law required that we measure schools using reading and math assessments as well as science that was recently brought on. I mentioned that in Alaska we do writing addition because it's in the state statute, as is reading, and mathematics is in our state statutes for accountability as well. I mentioned that we had to evaluate all schools the same way, Title I versus non-Title I schools, and we have to measure how many the makeup of their staff. And this is really designed to make sure that those students in Title I schools are getting the same opportunities, the same access to a highly qualified staff that knows their content. The piece that comes following that is there are consequences. If you don't make adequate yearly progress, there are certain consequences that apply to schools. But because the law only provides the funding to those Title I schools, the consequences only apply to the Title I schools. We can apply those consequences also to other non-Title I schools, but that's a state's choice. We don't make that choice in Alaska. Doesn't mean that we let all schools off even if they're not Title I, because Alaska has accountability requirements, and so we certainly examine the performance of non-Title I schools, but the consequences in the federal law apply only to the Title I schools that receive funding for Title I. In terms of the requirements, that's primarily the requirements, and I also provided you, you asked what it funds and what it doesn't fund. You can see, if you go back to the budget document, page 9 is the best example we have that lays out the overall funding that comes in. And then let me just briefly mention what some of these programs might fund. The Title I program is really designed, again, to support students in the low-income areas or in schools where there's a low-income population. So the types of things that you might see in a school depend. It really depends on the individual school and district's plan. But the types of things you'd see is instructional aides, perhaps a certified teacher in the area of reading that offers supplementary or support services to those students who are struggling in reading. There's also improvement dollars to help schools that are not making adequate yearly progress. We're able to put more money into those particular schools so that they can do even greater targeted assistance for those students who are struggling that get at the reason they're not making adequate yearly progress. There are also funds that come in under Title II, which deals with the staffing, and that's to help make sure that staff indeed are highly qualified. They know the content areas for the areas in which they teach. The main thing to keep in mind is all of these funds, regardless of what title it comes from, it all falls under NCLB, everything in that column under federal NCLB, and the focus is improving student achievement in reading, writing in Alaska, mathematics, and in science. Whether it's money that comes with a focus on technology, it means we need to work to make sure technology is used as an instructional tool that teachers can utilize in their classroom to better support academic achievement in reading, mathematics, and science. Improvement of those areas is given the that's where the focus is for all of the dollars. As you can see, just looking at our budget, it funds a large part of TLS and a large part of the programming that goes out. It, in terms of the whole TLS division within the department, it's about 59% of the dollars for that division.
And Les, I'd ask on TLS, you...
Excuse me.
For the people that are following this statewide...
Chair Seaton, the TLS is the Division of Teaching and Learning Support, which is the division within the department that does all of the support in terms of anything related to instruction within the school districts. It also is where our special education unit is. It's where certification is. A large portion of the dollars that they operate on and that they disseminate to school districts does come from NCLB dollars on that chart. So in terms of how it's working in Alaska and the kinds of waivers we've requested, generally, even though there are complaints about the law, it does provide support. It provides support in the areas of reading and writing. It's brought in programs, reading programs, where people have been able to look at how students do, provide instruction, look at assessments that help figure out how the student is and exactly what it is they don't know how to do at the program level within a classroom, and then provide assessments to make sure they're showing improvement. That's followed up by additional instruction. And when I'm talking about those pieces, it's not the statewide assessments. There are programs, reading programs, that people have been able to purchase and be able to get training and put in place because of NCLB that does things like that. It has, there's been challenging areas, and we've had to work through some of those challenging areas. For example, highly qualified. I mentioned earlier in my presentation that in small schools, having teachers highly qualified in multiple areas can be a challenge. But we've established a system in Alaska where through assessments, the teacher assessments, they can become highly qualified by demonstrating that they know enough about various content areas to teach in that content area. And so that's how we've met that challenge. Doesn't mean we've taken the challenge away, it still exists, but it does make sense that if you're going to teach history, you should know some content about history. And so the assessment allows people to teachers to prepare, take the assessment, and prove they have that knowledge, and then thereby become highly qualified. Chair, in addition, I heard you mention and ask for information about any waivers we've sought related to the law. And we have sought and successfully some waivers, and others we've sought and have not received, but would continue to request when opportunities become available. We asked, and I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when I testified before you, we asked to be able to measure student performance based on growth. For example, how are students doing in fifth grade compared to when they are in fourth grade? We asked for the waiver, we were granted the waiver, and we do utilize that system. Some of our districts have asked for permission to change the order of some of the consequences that apply to schools when they have to, when they don't meet adequate yearly progress. And we've been able to do that. We've also asked for a waiver to change what types of consequences we apply to schools when they don't meet adequate yearly progress. We didn't receive that waiver. Now we've carefully examined the states that did receive the waiver to see what was it about their request that was successful that's different than our request. We've looked at that closely, and if opportunities come up where we think we can benefit our districts by applying for waivers in the future, we're certainly going to do that. Right now what we're doing is watching closely what's happening with the new administration. There have been audio conferences where we've had the opportunity to listen to the new Secretary of Education talk about various things. Of course, right now the focus has been on the stimulus package, but we're going to make sure we're paying attention to look, are there other potential opportunities for waivers, as well as the law will go through some reauthorization probably within the next probably year to 2 years, where we'll pay attention to that and make sure that our folks, our congressional delegation, understands the things that would help make the law even more successful in the state of Alaska to deal with things that are challenges.
Okay, and we'll get into the stimulus package in just a few minutes. We're going to ask a question on anticipations there, so I don't want to get there quite yet. But Representative Edgman had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the context here when you're talking about waivers, Title I schools predominantly? And after that question, let me just throw in that maybe we can get a definition of what a Title I school in Alaska is.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the waivers that we're speaking of primarily deal with Title I schools because that's what the law deals with. However, and when I speak of consequences, we only apply those consequences to Title I schools. So if we received a waiver on what does a school have to do because it didn't meet adequate yearly progress, that would affect Title I schools. However, when we asked for growth, that affected all of our schools because we have to measure the performance of schools the same way for Title I schools as non-Title I schools. So by getting that waiver on growth, that affected our entire system and allowed us to build in growth for the entire system. A Title I school in the state of Alaska, there's a formula to figure out whether a school can be Title I, and I don't have the exact details of the formula, but let me share with you that if school has a poverty rate of about 40% of their students being in poverty or higher, it's generally going to be a Title I school. And then districts have various ways that they can distribute the funding within their district. They may focus it on some of their most challenging schools, or they may decide to have the funds go to more than just their most challenging schools in terms of the poverty rates in those schools. That's generally what the formula is. There's a great deal more detail behind it in terms of which schools are Title I and which ones are not.
Follow up, Representative Edgman.
Has rising energy costs push some schools into the Title I category?
Through the chair, Representative Edgemond. I don't believe we have more Title I schools, significantly more this year than what we did last year. The numbers change each year by a little bit, so I couldn't speak to that.
One more follow-up, Representative Edgemond.
So what percentage of Alaska schools are Title I at this point?
Through the chair, Representative Edgemond. We have about 500 schools, so in a little over 200, I think it's around 230, so slightly less than half, I believe, are Title I schools. And again, that number changes year by year.
Representative Wilson and then Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was one of the questions I wanted to ask, how many Title schools were there. But I want to go back to the waivers. One of the waivers we got was measuring the performance based on growth, and we got that, and I understand that. And then when we changed the order of the consequences to the school, what was that? I mean, how did it work better for Alaska that way?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the consequences, what happens when you don't meet adequate yearly progress for 1 year, you have to do certain things. When you don't meet for 2 years, and you're a Title I school, you have to provide school choice, meaning if a school is available, you don't have to fly kids to other communities. So this affects places like Anchorage, Fairbanks, Matsu, places that are larger. Choice has to be offered where if a school didn't meet for 2 years, they have to indicate here are two other schools that are not at the same level that would be schools where you could send your child to. And on the next year of not meeting adequate yearly progress, you have to offer supplementary services, which is tutoring after school. The request was to change the order of those so that they could be in a different order. That's not unique to Alaska, though. That's a request being made by lots of states and a request that hopefully the law would change when it's reauthorized.
Another question, Representative Wilson.
Just one more, and then I'll be done. Were there any schools that weren't Title I schools that missed AYP?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Yes, there are non-Title I schools that are not meeting adequate yearly progress as well. And actually, if you look at our Title I schools compared to all schools, we have a number of schools that don't meet that aren't Title I as well.
Okay, and then
follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Do we do anything for them, or do we just kind of, because we've got to zero in on the other ones, or they're going to be in trouble, what do we do for those schools that aren't meeting yearly improvement? What are we doing for them?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. In large part because of work that this legislature did last year with SB 285, not only do we try to support them in various ways, but we're required to. We actually are required to examine schools in the state and see what their performance is. If we find it deficient under state laws, we also try to provide services to those schools, whether it be making sure that they have access to consultants that can help support them, those kinds of things that might help improve their performance. What we do is actually do a lot more examination of those of all schools in the state because of the law that passed last year and try to determine if there is something that we can or can't do.
And one more follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Sorry,
And I want to make sure that the committee, we're going cycling through people. We can ask as many questions as we want, and that's what this overview is for. So don't be bashful about requesting a question, but if I go to someone else, don't be, and then come back to you. But go ahead, Representative Wilson.
When you said that that make available consultants for them, does the school have to come up with the money to pay the consultants, or does the department make sure that they're available at the school at no extra cost, or how does that work?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it depends. If it's a district where we intervened in, they may have to pay some of the costs for those types of things, for some of those services. But to date, the department has made available to schools in districts we've intervened in, and there'll be schools that are not Title I or that actually have even made AYP that we continue to provide support and services for so that they can improve. And so some of the some of those things have come through department dollars, either through state funding or also through federal funding that we get with No Child Left Behind. But in some cases, districts have had to pay for some of the things that are necessary.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Munoz and then Keller.
Thank you. You said that there were consequences to schools, Title I schools that didn't meet AYP. Could you tell me what those consequences are? And then with non-Title I schools, there aren't consequences, but apparently there are there is a state strategy to try to get those schools to improve.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, the Title I schools have a clear set of articulated standards. They don't meet adequate yearly progress the first year. They have to do an improvement plan. And it gets there are progressively more things that they need to do. If they get to the second year of not meeting adequate yearly progress, they have to offer choice, which means is there another school in the neighborhood? And then the district will have to use some of their federal dollars to offer transportation. That third year, they have to add to that supplementary services, the after-school tutoring. When they get up to levels beyond that, it gets more complex what they might have to do. They might have to replace staff if staff have been part of the problem. They might have to completely re-examine their curriculum and put a new curriculum in place that's clearly aligned to the state standards. And it continues up, and things get progressively more challenging for the, or not challenging, but they progress so that it's really looking at a redesign of the school eventually. It may be moving away from a centralized control of the school governance to a site-based, or the opposite, depending on which they think may have a bit greater effect in terms of improving student achievement.
Follow-up, Representative Munoz.
But then the non-Title II schools then deal directly with the state on an improvement strategy. Is that correct?
Correct. Through the chair, Representative Munoz, the non-Title I school, and I shouldn't just say non-Title I schools. Every school in the state also we look at because of the state statutes and state rules around accountability. And any schools that we deem are in need of that need to be looked at more closely, we actually engage in a conversation with the superintendent of those districts about each one of those schools, and we examine their improvement plans they have in place, what they're doing for those schools, and determine whether additional work needs to be done. And we can require certain things be put in place in those schools. They may be Title I or non-Title I schools, but that's sort of a focus on every school in the state because of the state statutes.
Okay, and then just one final question.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. You said that poverty was a determinant in determining a Title I school's whether or not a school is Title I. How do you determine poverty?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, the poverty is used by the same system of determining whether students are in a family that's high poverty as our food program. And so districts, there's a basically federal outline of what it takes for a family of two, family of four, family of 12 to be in poverty. And that same type of information is utilized for that to determine poverty, how many students or which students are in families with poverty.
Representative Mio.
So kids that, in other words, are eligible for free lunch are then identified.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, generally that would be true, and then the number of students within that school that fall within those categories is the factor of determining whether the school would be eligible for Title I funds at the district level. And the district has to make those determinations of which schools will receive those Title I funds of their eligible schools.
Thank you.
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the waivers, do you have a EED policy as far as when you talk to the legislature about the what waivers are? Is that part of the thick report? I mean, do you report that regularly, or is it our responsibility to ask you what waivers the department is working on if we want to know?
Well, through the chair, Representative Keller, at this point, what we've done is just we examine whether the waiver is going to make sense and whether it would we would be allowed to put that waiver in place under state statute, and then it potentially might mean we'd have to change regulations to put the waiver in place. But there isn't an automatic reporting mechanism. It's not part of the thick report. However, I have shared with you the waivers that we have sought, and we certainly would never hesitate to share that with the education committees.
Follow-up
is more of a comment, but when you're choosing between supplemental and schools of choice in the rural arena or the urban arena, it seems like the policy-making body should have been in on that discussion at some level, you know, or should be. And I appreciate the fact that you're telling us. And I wish I had been smart enough to ask before, you know, just if I'm interested in that. I'd just like to know how to keep up with it. So, thanks.
Okay.
Reverend Munoz.
Oh, just one final question. Thank you. Can the Title I money be used for innovative programming like language, early language learning, a second language, native language learning, other programs like that?
There certainly is a door open to innovative programs. In terms of supporting second language development, the funds have to actually be used for the other way, to make sure that students who have a predominant second language are able to speak and write and read well in the English language. And so under Title III funding, there is money for language development, but it's to make sure the English language is well developed.
Okay, and before we go on, I just wanted to remind all of us that deal with these things all the time when we're asking or responding to questions, EED, education early, you know, the department, or those kind of things, just so we don't lose lose folks that are trying to follow us online. I think people know No Child Left Behind, but NCLB is kind of the teacher segment, and you know, we're going to all members of the community here. So, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Les, I just you mentioned that you may have to replace staff in a school, and I was wondering, is that usually new staff, or I'm thinking with union contracts and everything, if they're tenured teachers and we have to replace them, have there been lawsuits because of that? Is that causing a problem at all?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, at this point, in terms of replacing staff within a school, where that's allowed under No Child Left Behind, is for a district to take action at a school level on their school improvement plan, and we haven't deployed that from the department end. However, because No Child Left Behind, but because of state law passed last year, the department does have the authority in a district where we intervene to replace staff under state statute. But that was very focused on people in instructional leadership roles, which may be the superintendent, might be assistant superintendent, might be a building principal. At this point, we haven't had to use that tool. It would be better, obviously, not to use the tool, but if we have to use it, we would use it because it may become necessary. There is a district we intervened in, however, where we strongly recommended to the district that they make a removal of a principal from a building, and they saw that that made sense themselves and carried that forward in one district.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Les, a couple questions. On the replacement of staff, you said requirement to replace staff if staff is a problem. Is there that qualifying? I mean, I know there was a lot of concern earlier that the rapid staff turnover in rural schools and NCLB, No Child Left Behind requirement to replace staff if it wasn't performing for over 2 years didn't make any sense when that seemed to be the problem. So was that a waiver, or is that just is there flexibility in there that staff replacement is if it's identified as a problem.
Chair Seaton, staff replacement is one of multiple choices that they have, and you're absolutely right. In Alaska, in some cases, what we want is actually the opposite. We want to try to have some continuity of staff and not increase the turnover. So that choice typically isn't deployed because most people are trying to do things to retain the staff versus see turnover.
Good. And in the either Title I or in those schools that are missing AYP, the statewide mentor, teacher mentor program, a principal mentor program, does that become more focused on those schools, or is that utilized in any way differently in a school that's failing to meet AYP than those that are not failing to meet adequate yearly progress?
Chair Seaton, at this point, that both of those programs, the teacher mentor program, the principal coaching program, have been districts volunteering to use them, and somewhat we've been able to serve almost all the people who want mentors or want a principal coach, but it has been first come, first serve in some regards. It won't be that way next year, I can assure you. We will make sure that first served are the neediest that need to be served. So if you are a teacher working in a school where the state has intervened because of challenging issues around academic performance, we will make sure the needs are served in those districts first before we make the program available across the state. And that actually where we've already communicated that with the people who run that program for us, and I'm meeting with them in a couple weeks to outline how that will actually work so that we do make sure we're leveraging both of those very good programs to serve the needs of our state the best that we can.
Great. And can you, well, while we're kind of on this topic, the new ruling on Moore versus State, do you see that as going to have impacts through what we're talking about here?
Chair Seaton, absolutely. Other than many of the things the judge had indicated, or some of the things the judge had indicated that the state needs to do to be compliant, are things we were doing already, we move forward with, we've been putting in place this year. An example is what I had mentioned in early January. I had worked with the people that run the teacher mentor program and the principal coaching program for us, and had already communicated to them as a way to support districts where we've intervened, we will in fact be making sure all the needs of those districts are first served before we open the programs across the state. So to some regard, the judge outlined things that we were on the path of doing already, but have been put in place to some degree after the October time when we were last before the judge. In other cases, she's telling us to get more serious about various things, like whether there's a number of things in the suit, and we've been looking at very carefully in the judge's opinion that will make us probably take a sterner, more serious look at some of those interventions in terms of requiring versus inviting districts to participate.
And on the list here, I didn't see, or maybe I just missed it, as far as the student lunch and student breakfast program. Is that included on that list, or is that outside of the funding source that we have here?
I'm unable to speak to that. I don't know where, if it's on here somewhere, but those programs are in place and in terms of supporting students, and it is part of this division, but I'd have to spend time looking here to
find out where they're at. Okay, and that's fine. I guess for explanation to us, can you give us on the growth model and the waiver, can you explain, I mean, we've talked about it. I don't know if you went over this when I was missed that meeting, but if you didn't, could you explain the other mechanism and then the growth model and what the department feels are the benefits of the growth model that we've gotten a waiver for? And did you say we're using that in all schools or just Title I schools?
Chair Seaton, the growth model that we have that we can use with adequate yearly progress, we use with every school in the state. It's somewhat complicated, but let me just try to make sense of it. What we do is we look at a fourth grader, and we find out how they scored, and then on reading, for example, and they get a numerical score, and we look at that score compared to the score they had the prior year. And what we're looking to try to figure out is, did that student make enough growth that if they continue that growth, that student would become proficient within 4 years? If they did, they've made growth. So let me use some numbers, if I might, to try to even make that make more sense. It's a student has to score 300 to be considered proficient on all of our assessments. So if in fourth grade a student scored 225, but in third grade they scored 200, they made a quarter growth toward the 300. So if they continue those kinds of gains, we'll presume they're on track to become proficient. The next year they'd have to get 250, the next year 275, and then up to 300. And that's what we would be looking for. Now, what I didn't add to that is there's some things that add complication to that statistically to make sure that growth isn't just by chance versus actual intentional growth. And so you can't take those numbers I gave you and just presume that we do cuts like that. We actually make sure that the statistical pieces are applied that make the model a little more complicated, so that when a student does improve in performance, it's truly improvement because they're achieving more this year than they were last year. That's generally how the model for adequate yearly progress works. And so we look at the one student, then we look at how they did on all three content areas, then we add all the students together throughout the school and look at how all of those students did in terms of growth. And we basically take any student who made the gains enough to say they are showing growth such that within 4 years they would become proficient. We take all those growth students and add to the proficient population that are already scoring proficient. And it's that accumulated group of students that are proficient or on track to become proficient through growth that then the school can count as they've done a good job with.
And how many years of the growth model and tracking that do we have now? And are we finding that maintains itself? In other words, when we identify somebody on track through growth to become proficient, is it happening?
Chair Seaton, we are only in our second year of doing those determinations, so I have not yet prepared to answer that question, but we do have to do that level of analysis, so once we've completed that, I can provide that, because a student who makes growth 1 year, we have to make sure we're looking at that same student to see if they continue that, and so at a future date, I could provide that information of how many showed growth for 2 years in a row consecutively.
Right. Okay, so we wouldn't be looking at a student saying that, okay, your growth is enough, so you'll be proficient in 4 years, and then the next year you're not making that to the 50% of the growth. Now, oh, well, another 4 years. I mean, so we're tracking that, and that's not going to be the, that's not the criteria.
Chair Seaton, we look at every individual child, and if they make growth 1 year, they have to make it again the next year to stay in the growth group of being on target. So if they didn't make the growth the second year, then they're no longer counting in the positive toward the school's performance.
Okay, and the thing that's very important about that is that the school, if it doesn't continue on that line of growth on those targeted students, then the probability is they're going to fall off of adequate yearly progress for the school. Is that, I mean, that's the hammer on this. Is that correct? Is if you don't exercise a lot of work to get growth from a student and get them achieving, they're not going to be counted for that, and all of a sudden the school Is that where we're going with?
Chair Seaton, that's absolutely accurate, yes.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, do we have any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Sorry. I'm looking at page 3 on our budget with the pie, with all the different funding that comes from No Child Left Behind. And I see that almost all of it is grants, so that it doesn't go to the schools automatically. Does that mean that they have to write a grant to get it?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, some of these are non-competitive grants. The largest sum of money is non-competitive. So if they meet the requirements outlined in the federal law and our state regulations to implement these laws, they receive those funds. So again, it is grants, but it just means it's a funding mechanism for the department to grant the money to the district and pass it through to the district. So again, majority are non-competitive.
Okay, and then the ones that are follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
The ones that are, which ones are competitive and which ones aren't?
Through the chair, I'd have to get back to you on that, but I don't, I believe it's, if you look at Title IID, Educational Technology State Grants, some of those dollars are through competitive grants. But the larger portions, the one that deals with improving teacher quality, the largest portion, that's 60%, those are non-competitive grants. So there are just some areas that have some competitive grants with them. Safe and drug-free schools, we're doing some work around alternative schools in that area. That was competitive grants through that. But again, the majority of the dollars are non-competitive.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, are there other questions at this point? Representative Gardner.
Thank you, and I'm not sure if this is a question for Mr. Morris or somebody else, but on page 9, one of the categories, component program, is a special ed state improvement grant support, and there's no funding there under NCLB, but there is federal funding and mental health funding. Are you familiar with any of the programs or the grants that have been awarded under this item?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I'm not familiar with any of the current grants that are funded, but there are what's called state improvement grants that come out through those dollars, usually to fund various ways to support students who are in special education performing better within the academic or within the areas of the general education program. But at this time, I'm not familiar with any of the current grants.
And follow-up, Representative Gardner.
Chair, do you know who would be a good person for me to talk to about that?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, we can get you information on any of the current competitive grants that exist and provide that to you. Either Cynthia Curran would be able to provide that, or someone within our special education unit. But we can get the information of which grants are out there right now and what their purposes are for you.
Thank you.
Representative Keller.
Yeah. the report card to the public, I commend you for that. That's a great report, and you go online and it's there, and you can look at all the proficiency, AYP levels, and all that. What time of the year does that get posted? And connected with that, do you have a list of all the reports that is due to the legislature and the public, a comprehensive list somewhere easy to get back with us so we know where to look and what to look at as far as what's reported?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, the report actually goes up onto our website in phases. As soon as we get the student information in terms of those students who are proficient or not proficient, that information's posted. So that goes up in late June in a preliminary fashion, and then in a final form by August. The rest of the report that provides more detailed information about schools is always posted in phases starting in January, and we get all the data we need from schools by the middle of March, and at that point it's completely posted from the prior year. And in terms of the reports, there's only one report, which you mentioned earlier, the thick report, that is required to be delivered to the Speaker and the President of the Senate and the Governor. The rest of the reports aren't required for delivery to the legislature, but are required to be on our website and easy for you to find in terms of performance, and it's primarily things around reporting student assessment results public.
Thank you. I guess I had a question on the state standards and measurements on the tests that we perform, how we track through. You know, Child Left Behind was, I believe, set up on the state setting their standards and their curriculum and their testing. And then in which grades do we competitively test, or do we test on a similar test so that we can be compared with the rest of the states? And how does that comparison shape up for Alaska as far as how are we doing compared to the other states?
Chair Seaton, we have two different tests that we give that are also given in other states. And one is called the National Assessment of Educational Progress, and that assessment tells us how Alaska is doing compared to how other states are doing as a whole. And that test is given in fourth grade and eighth grade. And then we also give what's called the Terra Nova assessment. The Terra Nova is a norm referenced assessment. It means it compares us to other students across the country. And that's given in grades 5 and 7. And in both of those assessments, the Terra Nova is the one that we get information down at the student level. And instead of saying how many are proficient or not proficient, it puts us at a percentile range. Where do our students generally land compared to all the other students? And generally, we typically fall in the range of about the 55th to maybe the 63rd percentile within that test compared to other students across the country, which may or may not sound real good. Keep in mind, most, you know, the average performing student is going to be at the 50th percentile, so you can't look at it the way you look at passing a test in a classroom in that percentile. We're slightly above the mean across the country on those. So in any case, I wouldn't put us at the top of states in terms of our performance, but we would be in the upper half.
And following up on that, does the department see any necessary changes in the standards or the progress that we're needing to look at as far as testing on a statewide basis? Any adjustments there, or does the department feel that our tests for AYP are adequate for the purposes of where we're going to improve school and improve student performance?
Chair Seaton, at this point, I think the department feels they're adequate, and maybe more than adequate. It's important to always be examining standards and making sure you have all the right curriculum in those areas. But at this point, it would make more sense to keep that measure consistent for a few more years. We've been about 4 or 5 years into this assessment, and so we don't have a need to push forward. There are other outside indicators. Federal law could require us to do that to match up with any national standards or those kinds of things, but we haven't felt a need to do that at this point in time.
Okay, thank you. Representative Boot.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. How are you doing?
Good.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate having your expertise here today. In the early 90s, at one time, I was looking at some data that was provided from this state in regards to the rest of the states, and the information regarding our standing there as far as the way that our students were testing was significantly different than it is now. Could you comment on, were you around at that time? Do you have that information? And I'm just trying to see where we came in the last 18 years, comparatively speaking, as far as the rest of the states are concerned.
Through the chair, Representative Book, I was around in the early 90s, but I was teaching and probably not paying as close attention at the time because no law required me to do that at the assessment results. We have limited information from the early 90s. One of the problems that we would experience is the tests, in fact, changed, and so the measure being different makes it hard to compare across tests. But we participated at various times on the one test that has been the same, which is the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And what I don't have that information in front of me, but I could provide you the results of the NAEP assessment, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, from the years that we did participate in that, so that you could have that kind of picture of where we were and where we're at today.
And Les, would you do that and you can just get it to us and we'll distribute it to the committee. Representative Boot.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I bring that up is because I did see those and it was significantly different than where we're at. We were testing in the upper 2 or 3% of the nation at that time. That's the reason I was bringing this up. So it would be very interesting to have those, that data brought before us, and trying to figure out how we got to where we're at, so that we can make some improvements.
Okay. Does anybody else have any other questions on No Child Left Behind? This is such an important topic that I want to make sure that we have all our questions answered and we all have a very broad general understanding of it, and we can get more specific as we need to, but that we really have a very thorough understanding. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Les, I'm trying to think, did we used to, as a state, take the Iowa Basic Skills Test? Was that one of the tests that Alaska took at all, or do you have any idea?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, at one time we did take the what was called the Iowa, that test. We now give a similar test. That was a norm reference test, and I mentioned the Terra Nova earlier. That's a norm reference test, and it's a test to give you a picture of how we're doing compared to other students who are from across, a sample group from across the country.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We have another question. Representative Gardner.
Were we going to talk about funding and stimulus money? Is that...
Oh.
Okay.
Did you... let's see. Yeah, why don't we go ahead and just take a brief moment and let us know what you see coming down the line, if we have any indications of that right yet.
Chair Seaton or Representative Gardner, through the chair, Representative Gardner, the information that we have, I still don't have information from the conference committee on the specific amounts coming to Alaska, but most of the money, there's money coming in from various directions. A lot of it will be funneled through the formula programs we have, particularly No Child Left Behind. So the greatest amount of money coming to the Department of Education or to education will be money that will pass through, be non-competitive grant situations that pass through to school districts in our formula funding mechanisms that we have in place right now. There are some other parts of the stimulus package that I wouldn't be prepared to speak to today because we're still analyzing the results and we don't yet have the exact dollar amounts that will be coming to our state in those formula funds, but we have a sense, but that was changing over the last few days.
Okay, and when you get those, can you forward them to the members of the committee just by email? Mm-hmm. So we are appraised of that. Representative Wilson, follow up Representative Gardner and then Representative Wilson.
Thank you. And then the second part of that is, do we anticipate that there will be significant changes to No Child Left Behind in the next few years?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner. It's hard to tell right now. If I had my crystal ball, I'd say they would be looking really closely at those things they think are successful and trying to build on those. But we are, as I said earlier, trying to really stay very close to understanding what the new secretary's interests and priorities will be, not only from his history of the type of work that he's done in Chicago, but the kinds of things that may come before that are that both parties are supporting in Congress. So I don't have enough information. I wouldn't anticipate changes in terms of the reauthorization for at least a year, however, and it may even be longer.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Les, is that money going to be able to be funneled through to the schools yet this school year, or is it going to be probably next school year?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I can't answer that. At one, I don't remember what the conference committee decided. At one house had one point put money in coming immediately, and the other house starting July the next fiscal year, and I don't know where it ended with the conference committee.
Yeah, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. We'd heard a lot over the last few years about unfunded mandates of No Child Left Behind, and it's hard to look at this page 9 funding sheet and see, you know, what is it that we're being required to do that's not funded, if anything? Or is it just a question of degree?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's a difficult question, because I think if we went off and participated in a study to figure out what the non-unfunded mandates are, we might potentially spend more on the study figuring that out than what is not funded. There are challenges. I mean, we have an assessment system at the state level that is required that from the federal government, but the amount of funding they've provided at points for just the assessment itself is probably beyond what it would cost to put that assessment in place. However, we use other federal dollars to help with the assessment. In addition, our state statute requires an assessment in reading, writing, and math. So if we had no state statutes, and if this legislature didn't care about student performance, we may have an unfunded mandate there, but we don't have that situation. The legislature and the state cares about student performance. It's in our statute. So it's a very fuzzy line. It would be very challenging for us to document what are the parts of the unfunded mandate. I think at the local level, when districts have to set aside certain dollars for this transportation with choice and those kinds of things, there is a concern about using dollars for something people may not value as much and not being able to use it to directly support student performance within that school versus providing transportation to the school of choice. And so in that sense, I think there are some of the challenges that we have with the law. But I could not accurately tell you exactly what's an unfunded mandate, because that would be challenging to find those pieces.
Okay, Representative Guttenberg, welcome to visiting committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was in and out of the room in the back, so I may have missed something, but it seemed like I've heard the parts of the question being asked. But you know, when we go down the road doing a program like this, we always need to remember that it's the child that's supposed to be the beneficiary of this program. Are we far enough along in No Child Left Behind that the administration would be capable of saying there's a change of the program that needs to be done that would be warrant looking back on all the research that has happened? So has it been in place long enough to say we need to change this, that the program has justified changes? Or are we still just at the first or second snapshot without it being able to look down the road where the curve of the results would take us?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I think the law has been in place long enough to look at some major programmatic areas like school choice, like supplemental services, and how those are designed in the law. But to make a major shift would be challenging now, because we have been assessing all of our students on a consistent measure for about 4 years now. We're in our fifth year of that. We've had the science assessment in place now about, this will be the third time students take that this spring. So that isn't enough years of consecutive data to make major decisions in terms of being able to find out, have we had enough growth in the law in and of itself? But we can recognize where there's some logistical problems in putting the law in place that just maybe don't work anywhere or don't work in some unique areas of Alaska.
Follow-up, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I'm trying to figure out the difference from what we have learned to the difference of the assumptions we could have made at the start of this program. We always know that Title I programs are are schools are probably not adequate. We know that if we don't put more money into math and sciences, the achievement level we can understand where that's going to be. But what's the difference between those assumptions and what we've learned from this program? Like you said earlier, the cost of doing those assessments might take up all the available funds and time. But I'm just trying to figure out if there's any lesson that is beyond that you know off the top of your head that could be brought to this program.
Off the top of my head, I wouldn't say that there are any lessons on the larger picture of measuring performance and making sure we pay attention to those things that we're measuring. My thought would be that those things probably are working and we want to continue doing those kinds of things, but there are fine detailed aspects of the law that we know are problematic and have known that would need change, but that really wouldn't change the focus of the law and the bigger picture of it, in my view.
Okay, and we do have, let's go ahead with all the questions we need on this, but we don't want to run short. Representative Wilson and Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know one of the problems that we deal with is the school of choice, especially in areas where there's no way to get to the school of choice, you know. And how many schools have actually changed where there's been kids that go from one school to a different school? Because in some areas, there's not a road, and they wouldn't be able to do that unless they actually live somewhere else.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's just a handful of schools, I would say less than 10, and you'll have 2, 3, or 4, somewhere in that range of schools in Anchorage, some of the other areas on the road system, perhaps Matsu and Fairbanks. However, the majority of our schools don't have choice available, so in those cases, they just do the supplemental services, which is after-school tutoring types of programs.
Yeah, Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that we have basically two types of assessment that we're looking at. We have a state assessment, and we have this No Child Left Behind. In your opinion, can you compare, or is it apples and oranges, which one is more stringent? Which one really gives us the advantage of looking at our state in a way that we can best address the needs of our students?
Through the chair, Representative Book, our statewide assessment is one assessment. What we require for the state and what we are required for NCLB, we've used the same assessment. Earlier in my presentation, I mentioned that there are additional assessments that districts have purchased at the local level that helps them at a more fine level target where they're successful with students so that they can continuously measure that progress over the whole year. So if I refer to two assessments, it's really that happens within a classroom on a weekly basis to target improvement toward the performance of the end state assessment.
Thank you for that clarification.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Quick question. In the situation where a family has the option to go to another school and have transportation to another school, and if they don't choose to do that, can they have the supplemental services that are available to those who don't have that option?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, in the schools that have to do both supplemental service providing and choice, that would be able to happen, where they would be able to have that and stay in their home school.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And you know, I know that we have focused a lot on problems of No Child Left Behind today, but I would draw everybody's attention that in the last 4 or 5 years, this has really focused a lot on measurement of student achievement in some very critical areas. And although we all have, you know, little problems and all, I think that we have to look at overall education has focused on individual children and their performance and growth much more than without the program. And so I don't want anyone out in the public to get the idea that we are saying that the program of measuring student performance, looking at school performance, is not something that we want to continue. We've got state laws as well, but we want to improve those things as much as we can. And I appreciate you coming in and giving us this overview, Les. Now we're going to move on to the instruction. Minimum expenditure by districts. Welcome, Mr. Jeans.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. I'm glad you had your discussion about NCLB before this presentation, because what we're talking about here is accountability of public schools. Mr. Chairman, the minimum expenditure requirement was passed by the legislature back in 1998, and it was the first step in accountability in our state for public schools. And because we didn't have the assessment system in place at the time, actually the state assessment was passed in the same legislation. So that's when we started assessing children in grades 3, 6, and 8. The legislature had an interest in ensuring that districts were spending money on instruction. And so the minimum expenditure requirement was passed in 1998 to help focus districts' expenditures on instruction. But since that time, I think we've moved more focus to the individual child, and we have our assessment system in place, and we have our student ID system where we can track each child as they progress through the public school system and how well they're performing in the areas of reading, writing, and math, not only at grades 3, 6, and 8, but grades 3 through 10, all grades. So I'm really glad that you had that discussion before we start talking about the minimum expenditure requirement. The Alaska State Board of Education passed Resolution 01 2009, and I believe you all have a copy of that, asking you to simply reconsider or amend the statute that requires districts to spend a minimum of 70% of their operating funds on instruction, in acknowledgement that their system of accountability directly tied to student achievement is now in place, as we just mentioned. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to start with the law itself. Basically, there's two times that we test whether or not a district is meeting the minimum expenditure requirement. The first test is when they submit their budgets to us in July for the upcoming school year, and we review those budgets to make sure that they're spending 70% on instruction, and if they're not, they're required to submit a waiver to the state of Alaska, to the State Board of Education, a waiver from that requirement. The State Board has two options. They can approve the waiver, or they can reject the waiver request and make the district go back and revise their budget to meet the 70% requirement. In the next step, when we review their data, is with the financial statements to see if they've met the 70%. Now, if they got a waiver on the budget, we don't have to worry about them meeting the 70% when we look at the financial statements. But if a district told us they were going to meet 70% and based on their financial statements they fall below, then we go through that process of a waiver request again. In this instance, though, if the board denies their waiver request, the sanction is we reduce their state aid by the amount, by the dollar amount that they missed the 70% instruction. I'll tell you that the Department of Education has recommended to the State Board to impose that sanction, I believe, three separate times. The local school superintendent came and spoke before the board and made promises that they do a better job, and the board granted their waiver on that basis. Through this process, which has been in place for about 10 years now, we've been able to identify two patterns that are very distinct. And that is, if a district has a budget of $3 million or less, that's an extremely small school district, then they're probably not going to meet the 70% requirement because of operating costs and so on. The second is if they spend 20% of their budget on operation and maintenance. In other words, if we have a school district that has their dispersed many sites, small student populations, just the actual cost of operating and maintaining all those individual sites will be 20% of their budget. There's no way they're going to meet the 70% on instructional requirement. So I think the piece of legislation that was passed had a really good intent. It really helped districts focus their expenditure patterns on instruction. It's helped us at the department focus in on categorization of the expenditures by districts. So I'd say we have more uniform data in terms of financial data for public schools. And then I did distribute for you this little three-column spreadsheet. This shows the number of schools in their the schools and their percentage on instruction. Back in 1999, we had 42 districts that did not meet the 70% in 1999. You can see the statewide average was approximately 63% on instruction. Now, jumping out to 2008, we have 22 school districts that did not meet the 70%. The statewide average on instructional expenditure is 69%. Mr. Chairman, I've highlighted a number of districts that have actually gone down during that time frame, and I put their average daily membership, and I would have to say that was the single leading contributing factor to them going down. They have fewer students. They have the same building to operate. Many of these are very small sites, as you're well aware. So these would fall into that category of $3 million or less in terms of total budget. The reason the State Board has asked that the legislature review this requirement again is, as I mentioned, we have an accountability system not only under NCLB but under Senate Bill 285 that this body passed last year that requires the department to look at individual schools based on student performance. And those that are underachieving, it requires the department to intervene in those schools. And the requirement under that law is to improve student performance through instructional practices. So under that piece of legislation, it actually allows the department to redirect how districts are spending their funds. Not necessarily give them more funds, but redirect how they're spending their funds. But as Deputy Commissioner Morris just mentioned, during his presentation, we also have funds available to assist districts to put mentors out in those districts to go in and look at their curriculum, help them align their curriculum, and so on. So I have to tell you, the State Board goes through this process twice a year. They're very frustrated with it because they don't see how it's tied to improving student achievement. The Department of Education is required to publish a report. We have a nice thick one here, which we've been doing for 10 years now, and submitting to Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, which under the statute, they're required to review the waiver request and submit recommendations to the State Board of Education. Now, in all fairness, I'll tell you that the timeline in which they have to respond and make recommendations to the State Board are pretty limited, and it's very, very difficult for LBNA to make recommendations. But we do put this report together, and we've been available to report to LBNA, which I've only done once on this particular issue. So it's very time consuming, not only for the districts, but for the Department of Education and the State Board of Education. The State Board is frustrated because they're not sure where they're supposed to go now, because we basically identified we're going to have somewhere between 20 to 25 districts that cannot meet this minimum expenditure requirement, and the law is very black and white. Either they meet it and get a waiver, or they don't, and we have to send them back to revise their budget. There's no gray area where we can say, well, we don't like where this money is in your budget, move it over here. Oh, but you still didn't meet the 70%. Does that make sense? So the State Board has been carrying out their responsibilities. The Department of Education has been carrying out its responsibilities. I think that the statute had good intent, but I think it's one of those that it's run its useful life, and we'd like the legislature to consider repealing that provision in the statute. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Eddie, and will you still get the budgets of the individual districts submitted to the department?
Mr. Chairman, they're still required to submit the budgets and the financial statements to the department. We're required to review the budgets to make sure they comply with state laws and regulations and that they're operating under a balanced budget. One of the greatest benefits that we've had under this specific piece of legislation is the uniformity that we've been able to bring forward through this requirement and looking at the budgets and directing districts where to allocate certain expenditures. So I don't know how many of you remember back in 1998 when McDowell Group did their education study, and one of their comments was the inconsistency in the way that financial data was reported. We've come a long way since then, and there's a lot of uniformity in the way that all that information's submitted and collected.
And Mr. Jeans, do you think there's still adequate requirement for adequate ability for you to require that uniformity going forward if this statute is repealed?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. And actually, I don't think we need this statute to require that uniformity. We have the uniform chart of accounts, which all school districts are required to follow. What we had to do was spend time looking at the budgets and how they categorize certain expenditures and kind of ferret out the differences between districts. And we've been able to bring that all together now.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eddie, I'm looking at the resolution, and it says at the very bottom, therefore, and it says that you said that they're asking us to reconsider that requirement, but this says reconsider or amend. Do they have any suggestions to amend, or are they really wanting us to just reconsider it totally?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's the only change in this resolution from the previous one that they passed, and they wanted to give you an option. If you weren't comfortable with repealing it, they would like you to at least look at amending it. What would that look like? They don't have an answer to that. And quite frankly, if we go down the road of amending it, I'm not sure where you would draw that line myself, because you're still going to have some districts that I cannot get up above 60%. So if you said for districts of a certain size it's 70 and others it's 60, I'm still going to be going through a process of having to grant waivers for the two districts that are below 60 every year. They're just so small that they're not going to get there.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Well, it seems like we have a instrument that was useful at its time. It's been bypassed. We now have individual student accountability and individual school accountability. We have interventions, and we have Moore versus Alaska that might have something to say about this as well. So anyway, I will be talking to the committee members, seeing whether we want to sponsor a committee bill to bring this discussion more fully before us. Is there any objection by committee members to doing that? I'm not asking for approval at this time, but asking for if there's objections to doing this as a committee bill, to bring it before us, and then we can discuss it and as a bill. Representative Wilson, then Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a bill that's not been submitted yet that it could be put in pretty easy. So it doesn't matter to me, but.
Okay. Representative Keller.
I would just request another time for a short discussion on it. I'd like to consider. I was going back here and comparing the districts that fell under that 50% rule, and many of them are the ones that are not making the 70%, and I just want to figure that out. I want to give this some more thought before We just, you know, I mean, I know that's what you meant, but I just wanted to express.
Sure, and that's what I am talking to the committee about, so that we have something before us in writing. It doesn't mean that we have to approve it. We can, if we disagree, we'll just shelve it, but at least then we would have something before us instead of a generalized overview discussion. We would have a bill. It could always be wrapped into another one, but I, you know, it would be better if it came from the education committee than from an individual, probably. But and like I say, if we decide that we want to put that in as an amendment on another bill that's coming forward, if that works, fine. But it seems like we have the department saying that they are expending a lot of energy. The state board is expending a lot of energy on something that does not produce any fruitful results with the change in time from 1999 to now, and we have better tools currently. It seems to me that we're always wanting to provide efficiencies and not have people creating studies that sit on a shelf that no one looks at or they don't generate. You know, if there's only been one request for a presentation before LBNA where the report goes, then I think the usefulness to the legislature is being demonstrated as not very significant. So is that okay to bring that forward as a, just so we have something in front of us, not right, requesting anybody to adopt it yet? Okay, so we'll have that before us as a bill. Thank you, Mr. G.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your time.
And we'll want to work with you on the parameters of that.
Absolutely.
That bill.
Thank you.
Now we have post-secondary education scholarships, House Bill 94. And again, in case the sponsor wasn't here when we talked about this, we have a number of issues on scholarships, and we're taking the bill up as part of that issue. We've heard from the Taylor Foundation on another program. We have, I know there was an article in ADN today about another piece of legislation. So there's a number of issues. So we're looking at this as a way to get out specifics of the issue. And so, Representative Guttenberg, we're not planning on moving this out right away, but it's part of the issue, and it'll be part of the mix as we look forward to how we can stimulate better education. So, appreciate you coming. Would you go ahead and introduce your legislation and yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Representative David Guttenberg. I represent District 8. I have before you House Bill 94, and I'm always delighted to come before a committee that the men have facial hair and the women are beautiful. You just heard.
Does that sound like a request for passage?
you just heard a long dialogue of No Child Left Behind. Perhaps we could begin this and those other dialogues of those other pieces of legislation dealing with No Graduate Left Behind, and what's preventing college, high school graduates and other people in the community from college careers and college and life successes. Rather than going through all of the things that are in the bill, and it's basically a needs and a merit-based scholarship bill, there probably are people online who have taken time out of their busy schedules that would like to testify, or Ms. Behrens could go through some of the things. I don't know if there are or not. I know we've talked with a lot of people.
We do have two people online. We have Dana Thomas from UAF, Michael Schultz, Fairbanks from ASUAF, so that's students, I believe. And we have Diane Behrens with us in the audience. Those are the only people that have signed up so far. If there are other people that wish to sign up, they can do so. So would you run through, so we have the topic fully before us, an outline of your bill and what it requests.
Okay. The bill sets up a scholarship program that's based on needs for and merit as well for those that are in need. There's clearly a problem, and we've gone through this in the past. When I started asking about this, the bill, for this program, everybody from the Taylor Foundation to all the students that have come out of the woodwork looking for opportunities that are hindered by lack of funding. National Center for Public Policy gives Alaska an F on affordability of college. The statistics are there showing that people do not get through school for a variety of reasons. One of the ones that we're able to deal with the most is is the financial costs and the burdens. We're dealing with eligible students. Basically, everybody that is in a program in the state of Alaska would be eligible who qualifies, and the qualification is set out in a variety of places. One of them has to do with defining what needs is and defining what the grade point average should be. For myself, the grade point average is actually a pretty significant threshold that I think is too high, actually, at this point, even in this bill. If you take a single parent with two kids that's working two jobs and understands that in order to get out of that, the hole that they're in, or just being a high school graduate and needing two jobs, then the opportunity to go to school, the economic hurdle should not be a hindrance, and that's something that we can do about it. But we shouldn't put the barrier of somebody having to raise a family at too high. That's a problem. We want them to graduate, and we don't need them to be an honor student or an average student. Just the ability to get through might take some of the pressure off that. So that's always been a concern of mine. That's actually where originally I'm coming from the building, is the returning student, the non-traditional student. The person that's graduated hasn't gone right into college and needs to come back. The merit-based aspect of it from high school students graduating from low income, there are a lot of scholarships available for overachievers, for lack of a better word. But this program I'd like to put in place so that there's certainty for people to understand what's in front of them, so they have the ability to attend college or university or trade school or VOC program. And understand what's in front of them, and they could plan for 2 or 4 years or whatever a degree or a program takes.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? I have a couple. On the 3.0 out of a 4.0 scale, 4 would be an A, so this is a B for A student. Only. So if someone has a C-plus average, they're not eligible for this. And that includes trade school or anything else. It must be a B average student or better. Is that correct?
That's the way it's written, yes.
Okay. And a unmet financial need of not less than $4,000. And how is the unmet financial need determined?
When Ms. Barron's opportunity comes up.
A degree or certificate program at a qualifying post-secondary institution. Now, qualifying post-secondary institution, is that like university accreditation? I mean, would most trade or most non-college institutions follow in that qualifying post-secondary institution? What is the, I'm trying to find out what the bill requires as far as qualifying post-secondary institution.
That's a very good question. There is, and I think we, in this committee process, we need to expand that dialogue, whether or not it is just a state institution or if it's a somebody that's national. In many instances, especially on the Bay, well, first of all, the trade schools, the union trade schools, are covered because there is no tuition, certainly the ones I'm familiar with. But the those other ones would be qualified if they're covered under this.
Okay. And so the definition on page 3, line 27, qualifying post-secondary institution means a post-secondary school located in the state that is accredited by a national or regional accrediting body recognized by the Council for Higher Education Accreditation. So are all of the schools and all of the trade, AVTEC, those kind of things, are all of those fall under that are in the state?
Most of them, but not all of them. And an example of some of those are students going to school in Alaska. This is where I would like to see it expanded as well. Students going to school in Alaska who programs that are Alaska-based, but the accreditation would be a university outside. And certainly, you know, I've known teachers that have taught on base that for a university that was outside. As long as the student's in a program in Alaska, and we need to expand this definition, as long as the student's is in a program that's Alaska-based, but it could, if it was accredited outside, like University of California or Texas or wherever it was, then we should expand this to include those programs.
Okay. Are there further questions before we go to testimony? Okay, thanks. And we'll follow up with you on that. Let's see. Let's go to Diane Behrens first, since she's here in the audience. Welcome, Ms. Behrens. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education.
Welcome. I was curious on page 1 under the findings. We recognize that existing scholarship programs in the state do not provide the funding needed to support all students who are in financial need. Does the commission agree with that? Just to make.
Yes, Mr. Chair, absolutely. There is unmet financial need in the state that is not covered by available programs.
Great. Okay. Would you like to just run through your comments on the bill, or do you want us to? You've heard some of my questions.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair.
Great.
And I would like to thank Representative Gutenberg and his staff. They've certainly sought input from the commission on this bill, and I think there are some things that I would describe them as tweaks rather than substantial changes. One that is more administrative is whether or not the record can reflect the level of authority the commission has to modify or to add extra rules for the program. One of the things that, as I thought about the wording of the bill and the fact that when there is insufficient funding available, we are to look to those with the greatest need and address their need first, it would be helpful to either have a maximum award amount specified in the bill or allow the commission by regulation to set such maximums. Otherwise, you are in a situation of having to decide how far the money should be spread when there is less than adequate funds available. Do you help 1,000 students with greatest need? Do you stretch it further to 2,000 students who still have substantial need? I think that is something that is better determined by the legislature rather than an administrative agency.
Thank you. And the structure of the bill, as I see it, says an unmet financial need of not less than 4,000. Do we have a maximum amount in here?
There is not currently a maximum amount specified, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
It would be presumed that it could not exceed their unmet need, but for some individuals, that unmet need may be $12,000.
Okay, so just so that I understand your point, would be that if we didn't have enough for $1,000 for everybody, it might be that the way it's written, we would could be interpreted that you'd have to give $12,000 to the most needy student and nothing to a number that needed some.
That would be correct.
Okay, so that's
And Mr. Chair, if it is appropriate, I would like to respond to your question regarding how financial need is determined. Under the language of the bill, it references the pre-application for federal student aid. This form is considered the universal form for needs-based aid determination. You can find a reference to that on page 2, lines 20 and 21. This was included in prior versions of the bill at our recommendation. One of the things it ensures is that all of the students who are seeking funds through this program would also be seeking other available federal funds. So it would ensure that they receive those funds first, and then it's only after that that supplemental awards under this program would be made available if they continued to have unmet need at or above $4,000. The way the FAFSA is the short term for the form, but the way the FAFSA works is for dependent students, it collects information about current year income or prior year income and assets on the parent and the student who on whose behalf the FAFSA is being filed. The formula has it's rather complex, but it calculates based on that asset and income information what should be the funds available for the family to contribute to pay that student's cost of education. That's the estimated family contribution, EFC. The EFC is then applied to the cost of attendance. In other words, it's reduced the cost of attendance, and whatever remains after aid, the estimated family contribution, whatever remains after those have been netted out, is the unmet need of the student. So that's what you would be looking at there. In the case of an independent student, it would be just their income and assets that would be considered in that formula.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Diane.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. In making that determination, the family income and the expected family contribution, there's no expectation that students would also have part-time jobs, summer jobs?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, what the formula takes into consideration is earnings and assets of the student the year prior. Typically, the FAFSA is filled out each year between January and March, and everything is dependent on the prior year income. There is no preset contribution that student would be expected to have earned during that period of time.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Diane, I noticed in the legislative intent section of the bill, it says reward eligible students who are admitted to a qualifying post-secondary institution located in the state. That would be the uncodified law part of the bill. And then the statutory change would be basically eligible students who have been admitted to a qualifying post-secondary institution. So the way this bill is written, the intent language would encourage the post-secondary administration to confine this program to in-state institutions. But in fact, you could probably still provide this to Alaska residents who are going to school outside the state as well. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, it is my understanding we would be precluded from making awards to students attending outside of Alaska. They, in fact, have to be attending in Alaska. And let me see if I can find the proper reference.
And Representative Edgman, would you point us the page and line
yes.
you're referring to on the in the statute?
Page 2, lines 5 and 6.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Edgman, if you'd refer to page 3, lines 27 through 29, you'll see that the located in the state requirement is specified in the definition.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gardner, did you have a follow-up?
I just wanted to say that on page 2, thank you, Mr. Chair, line 25, unmet financial need not less than $4,000, that would be an annual basis, correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Gardner, that is correct.
Thank you.
And Diane, as you read this, is there any limitation on the number of years that someone could apply and receive these? Or could this be a 12-year scholarship program for a continuing student?
Mr. Chair, there is not a specific number of years specified in the bill currently. One of the things that is somewhat assumed is that if you see on page 2, lines 29 to 31, it indicates that the student, in order to be eligible, to continue to be eligible, would be attending not less than half-time and is making satisfactory progress towards completion of a degree or certificate. That would presume that satisfactory progress is a set number of credits being accumulated in each term. So in theory, if they're going half-time, it might take them 4 years to get an associate's degree, 8 years to get a baccalaureate degree. If they're attending full-time, in theory, it would be half that. It might be worth consideration to add a cap on either the amount of grants a person could receive cumulatively or the number of years that they would be eligible to receive that grant. Because what can happen and increasingly happens is as students, particularly in the college environment, change degrees, if they transfer from one institution to the other, they may end up spending a number of years attending full-time and not yet have received a degree. The other point I would mention here is that currently the bill is wide open with respect to the collegiate level. There is no limitation to a first undergraduate degree or even to undergraduate study, so you could in theory pursue multiple undergraduate degrees, go on to graduate school, continue to qualify and be eligible under the bill as currently written.
And, yes, and I just point out the committee's attention that that has been something that, you know, has kind of occurred in some other programs where we have professional students that are available that, you know, are eligible. And the question is whether the idea is just keep people in school or to get people help Alaskans through school. And so I would draw the committee's attention to that as far as a number of years, number of degrees, dollar cap, something, so that we don't have an unintended consequence. Representative Keller.
Yeah, Diane, thank you, Mr. Chair. Diane, you may not want to answer this, and I understand if you don't. In your experience with the Alaska Scholarship Program, in your opinion, is a B in one district the same as a B in another district, or, you know, do we have a very careful standardization of grades between districts?
Through the Chair, Representative Keller, I really have no level of expertise in that, so I would just refer you to folks at the department who might be able to specifically speak.
Thank you.
And Diana, I'd like to ask about those qualifications. Does it necessarily make sense to say that someone had to have a B average in school when we're talking about continuing education at some later date, that they would then be disqualified from workforce development grants because they didn't get a B average in high school? That's the way I read the current existing qualifications.
Mr. Chair, I think that is an issue that you would want to look at. Although I haven't had discussions with Representative Gutenberg on this, I've had discussions on the bill in the other body, and there may be a need to have an alternative methodology for. I believe what they're looking for here is some indicator that the person is likely to succeed. So if in fact there are other metrics that we could look at that would be available to adult students who may not have been as focused in high school on their academics as they actually have capabilities for, I think those tools are out there. One of the things that we've talked about on the other body was looking at the work keys assessment that the department is currently promoting with schools to use, because it does assess actual competencies that may not necessarily be reflected in a GPA or a grade point average.
Okay, and so I would like to draw the committee's attention and the sponsor's attention to that, if we can come forward with some mechanism for accomplishing that, because I think that is kind of a dichotomy for where we're trying to go and the qualifications that we put in. Diane, as you were going through this, you said that the way it's set up is that the FAFSA application would require that all of the other things came first, and then that there was still unmet financial needs. So if someone qualified for the Alaska Scholars Program, is the format of the bill specific enough that says that all other things are applied first, and then there is $4,000 of continuing unmet financial need? It seems like it says that if you have on the FAFSA, that's there, and then you get two different things. You're not subtracting, and you're still qualifying for this.
Mr. Chair, I think the verbiage in the bill is sufficient. That is an area where I think the commission's administrative ability to issue regulations would make it clear that these funds should not replace other non-loan aid, but actually supplement that. So that would be something that I think the commission would do by regulation.
Okay, good. Are there other questions? Representative Gardner, and I'm sorry we are running over, but we will take a few minutes for questions.
I should have asked the sponsor about this, but Diane might know the answer. On the sponsor's statement, he says that an internal university survey found that the number two reason students dropped out was financial reasons. Do you happen to know the number one reason?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I could only speculate.
Okay.
And Diane, we're going to consider you as a agency presenter, and so that we really haven't gone through public testimony yet. We had a couple people that called in. I'm sorry we haven't been able to get there. If there's anybody that wants to pose any more questions, so that when we have public testimony next on this bill, those questions will be out there. Representative Wilson, did you have something?
I just have one.
Representative Kelly.
Quick thing, I think it's probably for you. Is there not going to be another fiscal note, right, from the Department of Revenue? There's one here from the full secondary. The fund, will that fund it? I think we just have the one fiscal note.
I don't know. We'll check on the fiscal note. Is there anything else, Diane, that you'd like to add on this bill or to highlight for us that we might need to be thinking about before we come back?
Mr. Chair, only the discussion about which institutions are currently covered by the definition. The Council for Higher Education Accreditation does focus its approval on collegiate institutions. So as Representative Gutenberg indicated, we would need a change to include at least two vocational institutions in the state which are nationally accredited, and they are ABTEC and the Career Academy, which is a proprietary institution in Anchorage.
And are those the only two that are that would provide workforce development training?
Mr. Chair, they are the only two which are otherwise regionally or nationally accredited and are located in Alaska. If your question is, are there providers of workforce training in Alaska who are not accredited, that's correct. There are. And those institutions would not, their students would not be eligible under the language of the bill.
And as the Commission on Post-Secondary, do you have a list of those?
Yes.
Can you provide that to the committee so we can see who would not be eligible to take loans under this?
And typically, Mr. Chair, there are institutions which are considered exempt from authorization, and we'll provide you a complete list of those institutions.
Great, thank you. Any other questions before we adjourn? We will be adjourned, and on you'll have to look at the list to see what we're doing tomorrow. I think we're having joint. I mean, on Wednesday, I think we're having joint meeting as well. So. Please check your calendar, and it was 10:07 we were adjourned.